So first of all, I'd like to welcome you all to our talk. We don't have a series of talks here. It's one we have sometimes lectures on and off. We never have a series of lectures. But this is the first one we're organizing within the parameters of the Open Society, the Alcus Barnes relationships. Let just me say a few things about this. Dr. Maha and I, I'm called Nadeem Khoury, by the way, I teach the science of Barnes, have been recipients of a fellowship in the Open Society that helps people who studied abroad, Palestinians studied abroad, come back. They opened the list to Palestine this year, but this applies to people in Eastern Europe and Central Asia. And this year they're moving to Palestine, Burma, and Liberia. And we, part of the fellowship requires that we nominate an international scholar that comes and helps us deal with some issues of developing curriculum, helping us with our teaching, our research, and so forth. And after a lot of deliberation, Dr. Maha and I nominated Dr. Stuart Eldon from Durham University to come and help us. And this is his first visit here, not his last, hopefully. And so I'll say a few things about Dr. Stuart Eldon and then you can do the rest of the talk. He's a professor of geography at Durham University and moving next semester to Warwick University. Has a training in political theory, history, philosophy, politics, and write some geography. Then, you know, some people just like to do a lot and make other people envious, and Dr. Eldon is one of them.
Interdisciplinary.
Yes, very interdisciplinary, which works wonderfully for us. It's one of the reasons why we nominated him, is because we want to work interdisciplinary and work with Spartans. And yeah, so without further ado, I'll let Stuart do the rest.
Thank you very much. You've made me feel very welcome here. I've enjoyed my time. I'm looking forward to coming back at some point in the future. What I thought I'd do is to try and talk about work I've been doing on the question of territory in a number of different ways. The work I've been doing on territory has taken different tracks for different projects over the last sort of 10 years or so. And what I've tried to suggest is there's a number of different registers and different ways we need to think about the question of territory. And some of that is very obvious political questions around the question of territory. And I've done work on the relation of territory to questions around globalisation, whether the European Union could be understood as a territory, to talk about the international legal notion of territorial integrity, and I'll say a bit more about that in a moment, and to think about what the sort of territorial dimensions of the war on terror have been. And in doing a lot of that work, it also got me engaged in thinking about territory kind of conceptually, about how we might think about territory as a concept, a political and a geographical concept, and then to think about it in relation to other political and geographical concepts. So how does territory relate to the concept of space? How does territory relate to the idea of territoriality, which for me are terms that actually need to be distinguished rather than conflated, which I think often happens in the literature. How do we think about territory in relation to debates about deterritorialization or re-territorialization and so on? So these kinds of ways of trying to think territory not just in a set of specific political contexts, but also as a concept in political thought, and to think about it like justice, like rights, like sovereignty, like authority, as something that can be understood as a concept, as well as the particular forms it takes in certain times and places. And then I also tried to do some work on the question historically, to try to understand not simply the history of particular territories, which there's a lot of good work on, but the history of the concept of territory. Did we always think with this concept? Did we always work with this as the particular way of ordering relations between, say, place and power or place and politics? Or were there other ways that we thought about that relation out of which the modern notion of territory emerged and then got extended across different parts of the world and across different ways of thinking about these kinds of questions? And the part of the reason that I've spent so much time on the question of territory is I was very unhappy or very uneasy about some of the ways that territory was defined. That quite often what I found in political geography books, in international relations books, in political science books, was territory was stressed to be important, and that there were lots and lots of things that needed to be said about the particular way that territories were organised in different times and in different places, but that the concept, people seemed to think, was straightforward. And the two standard ways that the concept of territory tends to be defined, and then after being defined, people run on and actually work out how it works in different times and places. But the concept was defined in one of two ways, and sometimes these two were combined. The first one is territory is an outcome of territoriality. Territoriality, particular ways that humans, groups of humans, interact with the environment, the places and spaces that they're in. Like animals, it may be to do with controlling, marking, excluding, including, these kinds of strategies, and that the outcome of those kinds of strategies is territory. And the argument would then be that because there's an extensive literature on territoriality, that means that there's enough to understand the concept of territory. Second way that territory tends to be defined, and this is a more sort of international relations, political science way of thinking, territory is a bounded space, and the state is understood as a bordered power container. You put a boundary, a wall, a fence, a ditch, some kind of fortification around a space, you enclose, you include some and you exclude others, that creates a territory. Both of those seem to me to be far too general to raise a number of questions that maybe needed to be asked rather than providing the answers, and they didn't seem to me to have any kind of historical specificity to them. These types of definitions seem to apply, according to the people that were using them, back to ancient Greece, through the Roman Empire, through the Middle Ages, to the early modern state, and the birth of the way we divide states, nations, territories today, that this could supposedly be used to understand China, India, Europe, North America, etc. And this sort of historical and geographical specificity, the kind of different times and places have different ways of thinking, that didn't seem to be included in those kinds of ways of working. So that you found, for example, this is a very good book on the question of organising European space, but you get this kind of definition appearing there about how a territory, a cohesive section of the Earth's surface that is distinguished from its surroundings by a boundary, or the Finnish political geographer Anssi Paasi talking about the relation between boundaries, the communication of boundaries, how boundaries are marked out, how boundaries are understood, how boundaries are practiced and communicated, and the construction of territories and the practice of territoriality. These people, and these are good examples, I think these both the books from which these come are very good examples of thinking about these kinds of questions, but neither of them really seem to me to get to grips with the complexities around the idea of territory. Now, the first thing that I wrote in detail around this question was a very political book. It was a book to try to make sense of what was happening in the so-called War on Terror, particularly focusing, obviously, on the period after September 11th, 2001. But one of the things I tried to argue in the book was that a number of the themes that were being seen in that last period had much longer historical antecedents, that they went back much further. And in the book, I tried to say it's not simply what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan, which were the standard ways that in the West people were talking about these questions, but that there were a number of other places where some similar kinds of issues were going on. Somalia, Pakistan, Yemen, Lebanon, and so on. And so what in the book I tried to do was very political, not very much theory, a real try and engagement with the kind of questions that were going on in the world at the time that I was writing. And the reason I got interested in these questions was partly because I've been doing this work conceptually and historically on territory, and I wanted to show in some degree what was it that kind of approach I was elaborating could help us to understand about what was happening today, what was happening at the time that I was writing the book, from around 2005 to 2007, and I was working on it. And one of them was a notion that you came up in a lot of speeches by Tony Blair, less often in George Bush's speeches, came up regularly in UN Security Council resolutions and so on, and this was the notion of territorial integrity. It's an international legal notion, and it applies to how we understand the relation between a state and the territory that that state has. So what was meant by this notion of territorial integrity? What was meant historically, but also how was it being understood in the present moment? So, for example, this is an example of a UN General Assembly resolution talking about the question of terrorism, but they're talking particularly about the things that threaten the territorial integrity and security of states. So what does territorial integrity mean? This was one of the questions that I set myself at the beginning of this. Well, it seemed to me that if you look back at the United Nations Charter, if you look at the discussions around the founding of the United Nations and so on, it means two things. Now, often those things reinforce each other, they work together, but I was going to suggest that actually there was a tension between them and these were being pulled apart in the present moment. The first thing that territorial integrity means is something like kind of territorial preservation or territorial fixity. The boundaries that we have between states, the territories that states are divided into today, are fixed, they shouldn't change. And that there was an attempt, since the United Nations was founded, that you would try and prevent states from grabbing the territory of another state. You would try to prevent secessionist movements from breaking away a territory of an existing state. Now, there are examples, of course, where this has been broken, but this is something that the United Nations, I think, was set up to try to prevent. They wanted to try to prevent something like the Second World War happening again. They wanted this idea of fixing where boundaries were and to try and create a regional and global stability through fixing those boundaries. The second one is that a state within those boundaries, within its territory, is sovereign. That the state should be self-sovereign, that it should be self-governing, that it should not have other states interfering in its domestic affairs. And that the United Nations Charter is an attempt to reconcile these two elements, one that might be understood as sort of territorial preservation, the other is territorial sovereignty, combine the two in this notion of territorial integrity, and that the United Nations Charter, the United Nations Security Council, the International Court of Justice, these would be things that would try to keep these two together and create stability in the post-Second World War world. This seemed to be the idea between what they were doing. But this kind of relation seemed to me to be under pressure from a number of different questions, and particularly in the post-Cold War period, since the fall of the Berlin Wall, since the end of the Soviet Empire, and the Soviet Empire particularly in Europe. And the relation between questions of sovereignty and territory and space and so on seemed to me to be well summed up in Henri Lefebvre's work. I've been very influenced by Lefebvre's work. I've written on him. I've done some translations of some of his writings. But in probably his most famous book, certainly in English debates, The Production of Space, he talks about the way that sovereignty obviously implies some kind of space. Where does that political power of sovereignty actually apply? Which spaces in the world does it apply to? But that actually is borne out often through violence. And that states are established through violence, they're constituted, they're created, and they're maintained through violence. And that state power only endures by nature of the violence being continued, but that violence being directed towards the particular space over which that state is laying claim. Now, what I like about this quotation that I think breaks from some of the standard ways that we think about this is that it doesn't suggest that violence is something that simply challenges the state, that violence is from the outside, either another state, a secessionist movement, a terrorist group. But what Lefebvre is stressing is that violence is inherent to the state, that the state itself is a violent act. It's a violent act of creation and it's a violent act of maintenance. And that violence that's there, maybe in explicit form or maybe more muted and more kind of hidden, is central to how a state is created and how a state endures. That seemed to me to be very interesting and very useful in understanding or sort of challenging the way that people often thought that there was the state and then there was violence against the state. That relation to me is much more complicated than that. The standard way I think that we often think about this idea is through the lens that Max Weber offers. Max Weber, in a lecture called Politics as a Vocation, given in 1919 in Germany, Weber's talking about what the state is, and he's talking about the relation of I think, four things in the constitution of the state. The human community, the area or the territory over which that human community is ruling or is situated within, the violence that may be exercised by the state, and the supposed legitimacy of that violence. Now, what Weber's definition does there, and Weber's definition kind of gets picked up in a lot of the academic literature, but I think also informs a lot of the policy. Weber was involved in part in the Treaty of Versailles after the First World War, for example. This kind of relation immediately says that any kind of violence outside of the state is immediately rendered as illegitimate. And what this suggests is that states are allowed to be violent and non-states are not allowed to be violent, or that their violence is immediately rendered as illegitimate as a result of this definition. And that this, I think, feeds into a lot of the ways that in the War on Terror people tried to construct the relation between states and terror. That states and terror in, say, the discourse of somebody like George W. Bush, these were entirely separate. There was the United States as a particular state, and then there was the violence of terrorist groups against that state. That seems to me to be incredibly problematic as a way of thinking about these things, and that you don't need to have the particular examples that you obviously have here in Palestine to realise that states regularly use violence and states regularly do things that act as acts of terror. And so for me, the Weber definition is masking the violence that I think that the Lefebvre definition is starting to show of how states actually operate and how states actually conduct themselves in a number of ways. And what you found, I thought, in the War on Terror, and this is the US defense strategy from 2005, but you find this in a number of examples of US policies around this time, was that the US started to challenge this idea that states were sovereign within their own territory. That they would say that there were certain states where that state should not have the monopoly of violence within their territory, but the United States or the United States allies should be able to intervene within that. Now, what they suggested initially was that you could use this along the lines of what had been understood through the 1990s as humanitarian intervention, or the responsibility to protect. If a state was doing terrible things to its civilian population, then it might be legitimate for an outside power to intervene within that state to try to prevent that, to try to prevent a genocide, to try to prevent something that had happened in Bosnia in the mid-1990s, to try to prevent something that had happened in Rwanda around the same time, or that there may be a number of examples where states were doing these things to their internal populations that would justify an intervention from the outside. But what the US started to do post-September 11th, 2001, was to say, this intervention isn't just justified because of what's being done to civilian populations, but it can be justified for other reasons as well. So that they would take an argument that was used, for example, in the Kosovo War in 1999, and they would say that this was part of the justification for why they went into Afghanistan in 2001, or why they invaded Iraq in 2003. And one example that brings these three different reasons together is from William Shawcross's work on what was happening in the lead-up to the war in Iraq. And he was claiming that intervention could be justified for three reasons. One is the prevention of genocide or the attack on civilian populations. The second one was that if a state was insufficiently in control of its own territory, that terrorist groups were operating within that territory. That was the argument against Afghanistan. Or that a state was pursuing weapons of mass destruction within its territory and that was therefore a threat to regional or global stability. And the argument then goes from this idea that intervention might be justified in some limited reasons to going to a much broader, wider range of thinking about how intervention might be justified. And it's this equivalence that the neoconservatives and others tried to suggest between those three reasons for intervention that I thought helped to explain or characterise what was going on in the post-September 11th world. It was the co-option of an earlier way of thinking to a much broader set of questions. It was taking the logic of humanitarian intervention but applying it in different instances and extending it. And you found that argument being used not just by the United States and but also by a number of the United States allies. So the United States may have used it in relation to Afghanistan and more recently Pakistan, or in relation to Iraq or how they're now viewing Iran or North Korea. But you also found it in terms of how India was understanding the question of what was happening in Kashmir. You saw that Russia co-opted some of these ideas in terms of what was happening in Chechnya. You certainly saw this in terms of how Israel was acting in relation to the Palestinian territories and to Lebanon. So that this argument was being co-opted by other regional powers in terms of justifications for what they were doing in terms of their own interventions within states. So that what my suggestion was in that book, one of the arguments of that book, was that these two notions behind the idea of territorial integrity, which when the United Nations Charter was put together were attempted to be reinforced and working together, that what you were finding increasingly today was these things were being pulled apart. That on the one hand, the United States didn't want territories to fragment, they didn't want territories to emerge from secessionist movements or to break up an existing territory along ethnic or religious lines. So they wanted the fixity of territory, the security they thought came from fixing territory. But on the other hand, they wanted, the United States wanted, and it allowed some of its allies to have the right to intervene within the territory of other states for those reasons that they were suggesting. So that these two notions, I thought, were increasingly being pulled apart in the contemporary world. And this was one of the things that I was trying to argue in that book, about the way that if a state wasn't seen to be sufficiently in control of its own territory, that non-state actors, so-called terrorist groups, secessionist movements, jihadist groups, however you want to describe them in terms of the way the United States and its allies saw them, if a state didn't control its territory, well, then maybe intervention was justified. But if a state was very strong and was in control of its territory, then maybe it could also be a threat because it was pursuing weapons of mass destruction, or it was going to be a regional or a global threat to its neighbours and so on. And so the United States was, I thought, using these two arguments for different reasons and in different places, but that between them they were putting real pressure on this international legal notion of territorial integrity. And I think one of the things that helps explain why the United States remained in Iraq for so long was that it wanted to prevent the breakup of Iraq into the different parts that might have been seen through the ethnic groups that were in the different parts of the country. That it intervened in that country because it saw this threat against a strong power that it claimed had weapons of mass destruction. It stayed in the country for as long as it did to try to prevent that state from fragmenting along those ethnic or religious lines. And so I thought the two parts of that could be explained by understanding what was happening around these territorial questions in relation to the war on terror. So as I said, a very political book, a book that tried to look at a whole set of contemporary situations, to not simply look at Iraq and Afghanistan, but to broaden it to other places, not simply to look at the period after September 11th, 2001, but to go back to understand what was happening in Kosovo, what didn't happen in Rwanda or Bosnia, and to try to fit this within a wider frame, both historically and geographically, to understand what was going on in the contemporary moment. Now, having done that book, I then returned to the more historical work that was really the thing that I wanted to be doing, but I wrote this book in part to say, this is why I think a more historically nuanced understanding of territory, a more conceptually nuanced understanding of territory, helps us to make sense of what's going on in the world at the moment. And that then, having done this, I always have that answer to a question of, why does all this historical work you're doing matter? What does it mean for what's going on in the moment or in this particular situation? So I started on a project that I understood to be a conceptual history, or you might say a genealogy, a kind of a way of taking a concept, a political geographical concept, and trying to write the history of that concept. So not just particular places and the particular territories, where their borders have been at different times and so on, but the history of the concept. Where does this modern notion of territory come from? And there was a book that was very inspirational for me, which was a book that was written on a different spatial concept, that of place, by the philosopher Edward Casey. It's a book called The Fate of Place. The subtitle is A Philosophical History. And Casey describes that book as an inquiry that traces out the idea of place vis-a-vis space. So how does place relate to the concept of space? Now, the concept of space has already had, in part, its history written. Henri Lefebvre's production of Space traces some of those questions, some of those relations. So how do you think about the concept of place in relation to space? That was Edward Casey's inquiry. For me, how did thinking about the concept of space relate to this question of territory? What kind of understanding of territory was necessary? What kind of understanding of space was necessary in order for there to be a concept of territory? The second question was to take that beyond the geographical and to start to think more explicitly about the political aspect of this. So a French geographer, Jean Gottman, suggesting that we cannot conceive a state, a political institution, without its spatial definition, its territory. So what was the relation of the state to the idea of territory? What was the relation of the state to the idea of space, and particularly an understanding of political space? And how might we think that relation between state, space, and territory as a sort of another guiding question in this work that I was trying to do? And what I tried to suggest was that if we wanted to understand how territory or other ways of understanding the relation between place and politics at different times had been understood, we needed to separate out the notion of territory from some other concepts which I thought were clearly related but were not the same and shouldn't be therefore conflated in terms of how we understood these ideas. Now, territory obviously has an economic element within it, a political economic element, you might call it. Territory has a relation to questions of land, to questions of property, to questions of rent that might be extracted from that. And so a political economic set of questions, some of the ways that Marxists have understood the emergence of the modern state and the territorial understanding of that state, these seem to me to be crucially important. They didn't seem to me to be sufficient to understand all of the elements within territory. The second one that I came to was the notion of terrain, or a sort of a political strategic set of questions. How do we understand the very physical nature of the territory, of the height or the depth, the hilltops, the valleys, whether it's barren land, whether it's got large forests in it, whether it's marshy land. And there's a whole range of work in what's called military geography or terrain analysis about a military commander needs to understand the terrain that they might be fighting over in order to be able to effectively conduct operations. So that if you have very soft, soggy, boggy land or sand, you may not be able to get tanks or heavy artillery across it. You may want to get a strategic point at the top of a hill, which would allow you to survey the area around it. And that you can find this back in writings such as Julius Caesar's work on the war in Gaul and the civil war in Rome. Caesar is looking at the places that he's going through as a military commander, thinking about where would I station my infantry, where would I put my cavalry, where's the strategically sensible place to be. So these kind of political strategic issues seem to me to be, again, really important, but not in themselves sufficient to understand the question of territory. So I was trying to think, well, what other elements alongside the economic and the strategic do we need to take into account? And there were many places that I came to that suggested some of these things that I could then work through in the historical and geographical detail. But going back to that quotation I gave you a few moments ago from Henri Lefebvre, if you look at the other parts surrounding that particular quotation, the relation that Lefebvre suggests between sovereignty, violence, and space, you see him starting to hint at what I think are some of these other elements in this idea. And it's particularly this sentence that I was interested in that Lefebvre quotation, about how that violence that's there in a state, that's there in the practice of sovereignty, that's there in the creation and the maintenance of state territorial arrangements, how that's partnered by a specific rationality he talks about. And he talks about that rationality as working in a number of different registers. One is the notion of accumulation, so a question of an economic set of questions. The other one is the question of the bureaucracy, so a political, legal, or political administrative set of questions. And another one is the question of the army, about a military strategic set of questions. And this particular kind of rationality, which Lefebvre, along with a lot of writers are coming before him, sees as emerging through the scientific revolution of the 16th, 17th century in Western Europe and then extending through the colonisation of the New World and extension into other areas. How does this kind of rationality help states to control, to demarcate, to regulate, to order, to organise the territories, the spaces over which they are exercising their violence? So it seemed to me that in there were a number of different elements that could be unpacked to think about the question of how a state operates in relation to its territory or its space. There are economic questions, there are strategic questions, there are legal questions, there are military questions, there are rationalities or kind of techniques of government type questions. And that all of these taken together might give us a broader ranging way of thinking about the question of territory. So this led me to suggest that if we want to think about territory, we need to go beyond land and beyond terrain, so beyond the merely political, economic, and the political strategic, and to take into account what I called at least two other registers or dimensions of the question of territory. One of them was the political legal, to think about law, to think about administration, jurisdiction, sovereignty, supremacy, authority, power, different ways of understanding these relations on a political, legal kind of register. How do these apply to particular spaces? How do these apply to particular territories and the territories that they're conducted over? And so in the historical work, I worked through these in a number of different questions. I won't go into all of these today, but maybe go into some of them in discussion. The second one was what I called the political technical, to think about how particular kinds of techniques, particular kinds of practices of government, of states, and how states operate were tied to developments that came out of the scientific revolution. So how advances in geometry, how the development of large-scale cartographic projects, of large-scale land surveying projects, of the accurate measurement of latitude and longitude, of how military technologies were developed following the scientific revolution. How do these kinds of questions, also alongside the legal, alongside the economic, the strategic, how do these help us to understand the modern notion of territory and the way that territory is understood and practiced? So this led me to try to suggest that territory could be understood similarly to how Michel Foucault understands the notion of population. For Foucault, population is something that is a political technology, or perhaps a bundle of political technologies. So if you think about this in relation to the question of territory, it's not simply land in itself as some kind of economic element that you can extract rent or you can extract profit from, and nor is it simply terrain in some kind of dispassionate terrain analysis that some strategic way of thinking might work in, but it's what kinds of techniques or what kinds of practices, what kinds of government ways of acting relates to these kinds of questions. So territory then is obviously a political concept, it's obviously a geographical concept, but I wanted to expand and stretch those out to say we need to think about these in the economic register, the strategic register, the legal, the technical, and probably others, but those were the ones that I was concentrating on. And so the point of this as a sort of a definitional, as a conceptual way of thinking about these questions, was not to say I now have a better definition of territory, that I have a better definition that could appear at the beginning of textbooks to replace some of the ways that I criticised a few moments ago. But rather, that what I was trying to do was to say, these are the types of questions that we need to ask in order to understand how territory has been understood and practised in different times and in different places. If we ask economic questions, strategic, legal and technical questions, I think then we'll get to grips with the complexities of the notion of territory in those different ways that it's played out and understood. So that was the point of the definitional work around those kinds of questions. So this led me to the second book on the question of territory, which is a much more historical study called The Birth of Territory, which is coming out later this year. And it's a book that tries to trace how that notion of territory, the one that I think too often we take on problematically, take it for granted today, how did that emerge within Western political thought? Where did it come from? What kinds of elements fed into that way of thinking about those questions? Now this is, I apologise for the size of the font on this, this is just to show you the table of contents for that book. It's a book that begins with ancient Greek myth and Greek tragedy that goes up to the early 18th century, that tries to reread Western political thought as a canon of work with these kinds of questions in mind, to try to concentrate not simply on the famous people, the kind of the Plato, the Aristotle, the Hobbes, the Rousseau kind of figures, but to look at some thinkers that are often not really thought of as political thinkers, like Descartes or Leibniz, and to look at a number of thinkers, particularly in the medieval period, who I think are neglected and are not really examined around these questions. So it's a very long book, it's a very dry kind of historical study to try to trace how this notion that we take today unproblematically, where this came from, where this emerged from. I want to move on to kind of briefly where I'm at the moment with the work I'm doing on territory, and to say something about the way that I've been trying to think about territory in a slightly different way. And this is to try to think about this again in the contemporary moment, but to try and think about territory in a way that I accept I probably didn't do sufficiently in previous work, but I think this is common to a lot of the ways that people think about territory. And this is the suggestion that territory we often think of as effectively a kind of a flat surface, that we think about the way that we represent territory in a map as the way that territory needs to be understood. That territory is understood as an area, as a surface, as a plane. But what happens if we start to think of different dimensions to the question of territory? If we start to think up and down in the question of territory? And there's a number of people that have done work that I think opens up some of these questions or these aspects, but I don't think this has really been brought together in a more sort of systematic way of relating. So I'm going to say a little bit about some of the people I found useful to think about territory, you might say in three dimensions, to think about the vertical, to think about the subsoil, to raise these kinds of questions. One of them is the German philosopher Peter Sloterdijk, who wrote a book in 2002 called Luftbeben, which would roughly translate as airquakes or air tremors. It's like an earthquake, but it's something that's going on in the air, some kind of act that's going on in the air. And it's been translated into English as terror from the air. And what Sloterdijk is trying to do in that book is to say a number of things that have been targeted towards civilian populations, towards the conduct of war, have come from the air. It might be missiles, it might be bombers, it might be poison gas, it might be different ways of delivering through the air a means of targeting and attacking civilian populations. And that it's part of a much bigger project, it's a three-volume project, and the Luftbeben book is actually a chapter within the second volume of this book, where Sloterdijk is trying to look at spheres. Spheres from the smallest, the womb that we are born in, through to the globe. And it's to try to trace these environs, with the three-dimensional environs, from rooms to houses to campuses to cities to buildings, all of these different spheres or enclosures that we might find ourselves within, that this is a way of opening up these kinds of questions in three dimensions rather than in just two dimensions. And the first volume of this, The Bubbles, has recently come out in English, and there's beginning to be an engagement with his works in English and to think about these kinds of ideas, these kinds of questions. The other person that's been very useful to me in a sort of a more philosophical register is the French architect and theorist Paul Virilio. And Virilio, in his early writings, was very interested in the way that warfare had challenged the way that we thought about the spaces of war, you might say. And he said that in the Second World War particularly, it happened a bit in the First World War, but particularly in the Second World War, three dimensions suddenly became important. In the First World War, it was through aeroplanes and the air war of taking things above the surface of the earth. Instead of armies marching across the surface of the earth, you now had a war that was going on above the surface. But in the Second World War, not simply airplanes, not simply the bombing that was done on a number of different countries, but also the submarines going beneath the surface in the Atlantic particularly, and using submarine warfare as another means of creating war. So what Virilio is talking about is how the battlefield, the flat planar surface, becomes a battle space. It becomes stretched out in three dimensions, and you have to start thinking about those if you want to understand war. And obviously, given where we are, I can't not mention Eyal Weissman's work. Eyal Weissman is an Israeli architect and theorist who's tried to make sense of what's been happening in the Palestinian territories, particularly in the West Bank, by saying the way that we have standardly understood these questions, the types of maps that are traditionally brought out when you go to the Oslo Accords or you go to Camp David and so on, these are two-dimensional cartographic representations of a space that really needs to be understood in at least three dimensions. You need to understand vertical dimensions, you need to understand the subsoil, you need to understand the way that you can't simply think of borders as meeting like this, but borders that might meet like this, of thinking about this in expanded sense of places. And the cover of the book is a shot of this road, of how you have an Israeli road over the top of a Palestinian road. But you start to think about this in terms of layers or dimensions to understand the complexity of these kinds of spaces. And in his work and in some of the other writing I've done, I've used some examples from Israel and from Palestinian territories to understand these different dimensions and to raise some of these questions and so on. And there are a number of other writers who have thought about related questions. So Stephen Graham, an ex-colleague of mine from Durham, Stephen has written about a book called Cities Under Siege, The New Military Urbanism. And he quotes from people and he analyses different ways that when warfare becomes urban, you need to think about things, what's underneath, what's the infrastructure in a city, but also the high-rise buildings. How does this, taking into account height and depth, how does this challenge or change the ways that we think about spaces or territories that are being contested? And there are a number of other people who've written books looking particularly at the above surface, the air. So Peter Adey's work on aerial life, or Mark Whitehead's book on state science and the skies, the kind of regulation of the atmosphere, about pollution and so on. So there's a lot of work on the kind of the above, aerial bombardment, the control of the air above the surface, of different ways that we might understand these kinds of questions. But what that didn't seem to me to be particularly well connected to was another body of work on urban infrastructure, on what's happening below the surface, of how does a modern city work. A lot of what makes a modern city work goes on out of sight, below the surface. So water, sewage, electricity, telecommunications. Some of this, yes, is above the surface, but a lot of it is going beneath the surface. So Matthew Gandy's book, Concrete and Clay, understanding how New York City is built and designed and how the infrastructure of that city works. William Cronin's work on Chicago, looking at the infrastructure that makes possible a city of the size of Chicago. Stephen Graham and Simon Marvin's work, Splintering Urbanism, of trying to understand the infrastructure within cities and how these operate, how these make cities possible. And in a sense, you could understand Stephen Graham's work as moving from, in the earlier work, Splintering Urbanism, particularly how do cities work, to in the Cities Under Siege book, how are cities taken apart, how are cities destroyed, how is it that Israel or NATO often target the infrastructure of the places that they are attacking as one of the first things that they do. What did NATO do in Belgrade in the Kosovo War? It took out things like the electricity grid. It took out telecommunication systems. It did the same kind of thing in Iraq. If you can turn a city off or switch a city off, then it makes it more easy to subjugate that city and to get what you want through those questions. I'll move just briefly to Paul Virilio's work before kind of concluding. Virilio, for me, was very interesting in some of his earliest writings. Virilio moved away from this and starts talking about a number of different questions in his writings from the mid-1970s. But in his works in the 1960s and 1970s, I think he does some very interesting things about architecture and about military architecture in particular. And he's interested in the Atlantic Wall. This was a series of defences that were built along the French coastline by the Germans when France was occupied in the Second World War as part of a defence against the expected Allied invasion. And he looks at these architectural remains that he found in the places where he was growing up and where he was a young boy, and looking at these as a kind of a model for a different style of architecture. And the Bunker Archaeology book has a number of photographs that he took of these places, of understanding these kinds of architectural military installations that he was finding in those places. Some of them are rocket silos, some of them are these installations that were there with these very small openings that could be used to fire out but were very difficult to target or to fire in, where much of the building was hidden beneath the surface so that it's playing with what's above and what's below the surface in terms of the construction of these. And he's talking about this in terms of opening up the kind of the volume question, moving away from a flat surface or an area to opening up what's below the surface, what's above the surface in terms of military architecture and how this might change how we think about questions of territory. It's a whole range of pictures from the book where he's talking and showing these kinds of buildings and what they make possible. But he didn't simply use these as a way of thinking about what had been done in the past, but he also used these to understand what might be done in the future. He wasn't just somebody who was analysing buildings, he was also an architect, a practising architect himself. And along with Claude Parent, two of them are down there in the bottom left, they built a number of buildings, which are a number of plans and a number of the photographs of these buildings are in this book, The Function of the Oblique. And the bottom right building here, you can very clearly see modelled on the kind of style that he found in those settings in the German fortifications in France. This building at the bottom right is one that Parent and Virilio built. It's actually a church. And you can see from the design of that building how they've taken this kind of military architecture to look at it. But in a sense, what's interesting about these buildings is not what's on the outside, what you see from the outside, because so much of the building is actually hidden, it's below the surface, that the outside is really to allow the construction of a new space internal to this building. And that what he's thinking about here is instead of thinking simply about the vertical being a dimension that goes straight up or straight down, that we need to think about what he calls the oblique. Things at an angle, things that are on a plane, things that are not simply organised on flat surfaces and vertical surfaces, but about how if you start to think about things at an angle or an incline, then this might change the kind of perception of space that you would think about these kinds of questions. And that what he's doing in this work is to try to suggest that if we start to think about space as a volume, it isn't sufficient simply to think about what's up and what's down in a straightforward way. But if we're to make sense of things like tunnels, bridges, inclines, the kind of spaces that I think help to make sense of what's happening here in Palestine in terms of how Israel is building military architecture, how it's building civilian architecture to make possible the occupation, then if you think about space in this kind of way of thinking not just up, not just down, but thinking about surfaces, inclines, planes, angles, these kinds of ways of thinking about space as a volume open up, for me at least, a different set of dimensions around the question of territory. Now, there's a number of other people that I found useful in this work, but I just wanted to really end with a quote from Michel Foucault. This is a short piece that he wrote to accompany a catalogue of the architectural and the painting work of Paul Rebouret, a French artist. And it was a series of installations of the idea of dogs. And that the dogs, he thought, were interesting because they started to open up questions around the idea of prisons. Foucault was writing about the question of prisons in the early 1970s, before the book Discipline and Punish. But what he's suggesting here is it's not simply that the vertical and raising this different dimension to the question of territory is simply a spatial question, but it's inherently related to the question of power. And so thinking, I think, around those different sets of dimensions helps us to understand the complexities around this idea of territory. So the idea that I have, and this is the kind of ongoing work that I've got, is to move beyond that political work and that historical work that I've done on the question of territory and to open up a whole set of different questions, one of which is this question of volume, another one is the way of thinking about geopolitics, but it's still to continue these kinds of questions around the idea of territory, but to think about it with all of these different dimensions that I've been suggesting today. Thank you.